I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. They can walk, run, climb, and fly. They work the assembly line in factories, can help out on the farm, assist in the operating room, fight enemy combatants, and patrol drug tunnels. And maybe sometime in the near future, they will deliver packages to our homes. Robot design and development has been advancing quickly. Robots are developing greater autonomy and dexterity and are learning to do what humans do. So today on Radio Times, robots, how far they have come and what the future holds. And we have three leading roboticists, all affiliated with the University of Pennsylvania, who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. And let me introduce them to you. Daniel Lee is a professor in the Department of Electrical and Systems Engineering, director of the GRASP Lab at the University of Pennsylvania. And Daniel Lee, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
Also with us is Catherine Kuchenbecker, and she's Associate Professor of Mechanical Engineering and Applied Mechanics and Computer and Information Science at the University of Pennsylvania as well. And Catherine, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
And our third guest is Vijay Kumar, the UPS Foundation Professor in the School of Engineering and Applied Science at Penn, currently on sabbatical leave as the Assistant Director of Robotics and Cyber Physical Systems at the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. And Vijay Kumar, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for inviting me.
So are all three of you designing our robot overlords? Daniel?
Hopefully not too soon. So we'll see how quickly we can do that.
But is that a bad joke, Vijay?
I think it's a bad joke. I think if you think about robots that we are working with, they're all designed to serve humans and work with humans. And yes, maybe, you know, someday you might think about artificial intelligence progressing to a point where sort of machines can become independent. But even if that happens, it's really unlikely that they're going to take decisions that the designers did not intend them to take.
So we should think, Catherine, as them as what, friends, allies?
I think of robots
fellow travelers
more as tools currently that humans can use to accomplish things they couldn't do unassisted. That's often the goal of the work that we're doing in my lab.
And why Penn? I mean, what is happening at Penn that all three of you are there and other people as well, Vijay?
Well, if you go
You've
back,
been there 25 years.
Yes,
right?
I've been there for 25 years. If you go back to the history of Penn, obviously established by Ben Franklin, and he really did think about how the basic science and its applications would come together in terms of new inventions and so on. And if you think about it, if Ben Franklin had been alive today, he would be doing robotics, right? It is really sort of the quintessential integration of different basic science technologies into physical products into that actually help people. And that's the culture that we have at Penn.
Well, what's interesting to think about, and I'm going to have each of you talk about your research, but I'll toss this back to you, Daniel, which is just how much robots, when you think about it, are currently involved in our daily lives.
Yes, we try to have them, as Catherine said, as tools. But one of the things that we still don't understand is how to make them intelligent enough that they can work effectively with humans. And that's a big problem. And that's why I think at Penn we have this nice interdisciplinary program where you have people from mechanical engineering, from electrical engineering, from computer science. Robotics is really truly, as Vijay mentioned, an interdisciplinary discipline where you need to have a combination of many, many fields and talents to build a successful robot.
And Catherine, how did you get into robotics?
Oh, that's a funny story. When I was really young, I actually had a very scary encounter with an animatronic robot at an amusement park. And my mom, being a child development psychologist, realized that my terror of robots was unhealthy. And so systematically tried to expose me and teach me about robots. And we got little robot wind-up toys, took them apart. And I don't think she realized she was creating a robotics professor and helping me handle this terrifying interaction.
Well, isn't that called systematic desensitization?
Yes.
And it worked.
My mom
you.
Is a very smart woman, and I'm grateful because robotics is a fascinating area to work in because you get to work in so many different disciplines. You get to design and build things and make circuits and program them and try to puzzle out how to emulate the amazing dexterity or mobility of living organisms to contribute to society.
Vijay, you brought in two robots here that are sitting on the table, and these are quad rotors. Can you describe them to our listeners?
Sure. They're both flying robots. They're called quad rotors because each have four rotors. One of them is about half a meter in diameter. The other one is about 5 inches in diameter. So they both fly autonomously. They have onboard computers that regulate the speeds of the rotors to make them fly in different directions, rotate, and so on. They're equipped with cameras, which they can then use for autonomous navigation. One of them has GPS, So if they're outdoors, they can use GPS signals to navigate from one point to another.
Are they also called drones? Are these drones?
I don't use the word drones. In fact, you know, if you look at the word drone, it actually signifies something that's dumb. If you look at drones used by the military, those are not drones either because they're really controlled by humans, and to call humans dumb would be the wrong thing. So if you look at these machines, we program them to be intelligent, to be smart, to sense the environment, reason about the environment, and make decisions that the human designers intend them to make.
In fact, we put a little video on our Facebook page that a piece of music that's performed, I guess, by these drones.
So that was just an interesting experiment we did to explore some of the non-conventional uses of these little robots. But it's unclear that, you know, something like that would really find applications in the real world.
These drones think, if I can use that word, operate in a 12D universe?
Right, so now I'm going to get a little geeky here, but if you think about positions, there are three positions: horizontal, two horizontal, and one vertical position. Likewise, there are three orientations. And we want to think not only about the positions and orientations, but also the rates of change of positions and orientations, which we typically call speeds. But in fact, there are six position and orientation variables and correspondingly six speeds, and therefore you have 12 dimensions.
And these robots are used and they have practical application.
They have practical applications, so we think of them as possibly having roles in first response and emergency response. After the Fukushima disaster or, you know, during the Yarnell fire in Arizona last summer, you could imagine these robots actually helping human first responders. So that's an application area we're very interested in. We could also think of them with applications in precision farming, looking at plants, monitoring their health, monitoring the extent of the canopy size, how fast the plant is growing, counting the number of apples on trees. So there are lots of little things that you can do to really improve the productivity of our society.
And I want to pick up on that. Catherine, let me turn to you. You work in the field of haptics.
I do. Haptics centers on physical contact between an agent, a robot, and the world around it. Current robots are very good, or pretty good, at seeing the world around them, but they're kind of blind through their sense of touch. They don't typically have very good contact sensations, which is okay for a quad rotor that's just going to fly around a field and count apples. But if you want to have a robot, say, in your home to clean up your kitchen, put away your dishes.
I'm all there.
Yeah, I'd love that too. It's going to have to reach out and pick up objects, move them around without damaging them. And so to do that, a robot needs a really good sense of touch as well. And that's one of the big things we work on in my lab.
One of the talks that I saw you give just sort of underscores how incredible the human hand is and our ability to not just grasp things, but also to touch and feel things.
Yes, you can perceive a remarkable array of different characteristics of the objects in the world around you and use that information to create, like, move very elegantly. I also do a lot of work on synthesizing, using robot technology to fool the human sense of touch, to say teach a doctor a new procedure they can hold onto the end of a robot and then move it around, and the robot can present forces and sensations that makes it feel as though they're touching a surface or tissue, even though it's not really there. So they could practice and learn how to do some manual skill with a computer game that you can feel instead of on a real patient.
So how do you get a robot to have this sense of touch? I'm struggling with my language here. Go ahead, Catherine.
Well, there are actually two different things we just talked about, and they're a little different. But in our lab, all of us work with the Personal Robot 2, a robot that was made by Willow Garage. And to give it a better sense of touch, we had to endow it with better tactile sensors. When you just buy one, it can tell when there's pressure only on its little fingertips, and it has a vibration sensor in its hand. So we had to write a bunch of software to intelligently process those signals so that when the robot's fingers, say, touch a coffee cup, it can tell that it's a coffee cup, figure out how hard to squeeze, and when it sets the coffee cup down on the table, it can feel that contact and know to let go and move on to the next thing. So that's the first aspect of endowing robots with the capability of physically interacting with the world. They have to be able to feel things. On the flip side, the other thing I was talking about, how do we fool a robot, yeah, or fool a human sense of touch? Again, we have to be able to measure the sensations that we want to present. So we put sensors on real instruments and record them and then play them again later for someone to feel.
Well, I want to pick up on that as well, but let me get you in the, on the conversation. Daniel Lee, you're director of the GRASP Lab. What is the GRASP Lab involved in?
So, yeah, we're all part of the GRASP Lab here, and we have other faculty who specialize in different areas. So there's people working on computer vision, people working on learning, having the robots learn how to do things, people working on robot locomotion, not just flying, but walking and running. So this is all the kind of combination of abilities that we want to endow these robots, sensing, the ability to locomote in different environments, and to be able to reason about uncertain actions and responses to the world.
And it's hard to get a robot to walk, right? I mean, we're talking about stability, balance, all those things that we do without thinking.
Exactly. So if you saw kind of the early robots walking, they all had six legs. And the reason why you have six legs is if you you can always keep three legs on the ground and you're always and statically balanced. But now if you look at how humans walk with two legs, that really requires a lot of brain power just to be able to take your haptic sense coming right. from your bottom of your feet, and then being able to use then your vestibular system in your ears to kind of get that sense of balance, and then to be able to control your legs to walk.
You have put together a soccer team. I think it was dogs, and now we're on to people.
Sure, yes. Yeah,
from to two legs.
Exactly. We have something called an autonomous robot soccer team, which is basically a team of robots that play soccer with other teams of robots.
And is it for fun, or obviously there are things you're learning about movement, I'm assuming.
Exactly, and this is actually a grand challenge problem, and at some day they would like to have actually a team of robots play the World Cup championship team of humans in a match someday, and that's kind of the goal of that project.
RoboCup, is that what it's called?
Exactly.
I was going to say, are the robots going to win, Dan?
At some point, but we're very far away from that goal at this time.
But the idea, I guess, of dog, is it just the dogs are cuter, the dogs have four legs, and that's why you started with dogs?
We started because it was easier to walk with four legs. But now we do what we call bipedal, meaning just two legs.
Right. Mm-hmm. But the idea is with two legs, and you know, we have to think about what we do, again, without thinking. The idea of balance and stability and moving one in front of the other. And if you're playing a soccer match, you have to be able to navigate around a field as well.
Yeah, and people are pushing you at the same time, and that makes it even harder is when you have some external forces hitting you, you need to be able to kind of anticipate that and to balance yourself. And with two legs, basically, as humans, we're falling over all the time. Right. So when we have some brain deficit, we see those kinds of problems, and it's the same things that we see with the robots.
And we're almost having a break here, but does working with robots help you appreciate what humans have been able to do? You're nodding your head, Catherine.
Absolutely. I think trying to program a robot to do any task that humans do easily really humbles you and makes you realize how many challenges there are, because it's synthesizing the perception, the planning, the acting, the reacting. It's much trickier than it might look at the outside. That's why I think we're actually much farther away from the robot overlords than one might naturally fear.
Well, let's take that very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with three leading roboticists who happen to be all affiliated with the University of Pennsylvania, Catherine Kuchenbecker, Daniel Lee, and Vijay Kumar. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Executive Doctorate of Business Administration at Temple University's Fox School of Business supports WHYY. This 3-year applied research-focused degree is designed to provide experienced business leaders the skills to address tomorrow's challenges. Executive DBA students receive faculty mentorship, online collaboration, and the Fox School's reputation for high-quality research. Temple University Fox School of Business. Discover the power of Fox. Learn more at fox.temple.edu/executive-dba.
Next time on The Pulse,
CIMEX
LECT
ULAR
IUS
CIMEX Lectularius,
also known as bed bugs.
Oh my god, it's bed bug.
The people who are terrified by them,
and I grabbed a tissue and I squeezed it like, ugh.
And the scientists tracking and fighting their spread.
they sense the CO2 in her breath. You can see they got very excited. Now they're crawling up and down the paper.
The Pulse, tomorrow morning at 9 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, instead of freezing in fear, Deborah Cohen danced before her double mastectomy.
I made the video for myself so that I would be able to watch myself dancing after surgery.
Now that video is part of a major ad. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen getting a primer and an update on the field of robotics with Daniel Lee, Catherine Kuchenbecker, and Vijay Kumar. And again, you can give us a call. Any questions or comments you might have, do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Vijay, I keep looking at these robots that you have brought in here. And one of the things that I learned from your TED Talk was that you looked at ants and how ants work together, and some of that study helped went into some of the thinking with robots, or these particular robots, I guess.
Right. So I think, as Catherine said, I think a lot of the inspiration from robotics does come from nature. We look at humans, we look at ants, we look at bees, and oftentimes nature has solved these problems first. And for us, it's both sort of an intellectual and a technological challenge, first to understand how biology solves these problems, and then technologically how to actually create organisms, living organisms, that are endowed with sort of the physical infrastructure that might actually emulate these ants. So I think ants and other kinds of creatures. So that's really been the undercurrent of robotics right from its inception back in the 60s. So from our standpoint, we like ants because they're easy to study. They're inherently social animals. They interact with each other to perform tasks that they individually could not perform. And we'd love for robots to do exactly the same thing. So that's why we study ants.
Well, and what we see in this video are these flying robots, in a sense, working together. They have a task that they're working on, sort of like the ants trying to carry something perhaps into their little hole.
Correct. I mean, the robots we try to build are very small so that we can make them maneuverable and operate in constrained indoor environments. But when you make things small, you also make them weaker in some sense. So they really have to collaborate to carry things, for instance. So that's an example of a task that we couldn't really do unless we get these robots to behave like social insects.
Catherine, talk a bit about these touch screens that you have been working on.
Yeah, so right now any device, a screen-enabled device, say an iPhone that you have, can feel your touch. It knows where you're interacting with it. But it always feels the same. It always feels like a piece of glass. And real buttons that you press or real surfaces in the world feel much richer than that. So my lab, for several years now, has been working on how do we add haptic feedback to screens like that. We started working on this many years ago when styluses were more the mode of interaction. So we'd taken a Wacom tablet and modified it and made it so that you can take the stylus, drag it across the screen, and feel any one of hundreds of textures, surfaces, say like a piece of corduroy or a piece of stone, and you can move from one area of the screen to another, and both we visually depict the two surfaces, then you can also feel the tip of the tool moving across, even though it is still just a piece of glass. Mm. We've added a little motor, a voice coil actuator that shakes back and forth in just the right way, with signals that we built from real recordings of real surfaces, to make you feel almost as though you're touching these various surfaces. And we see this could add a lot more richness to touchscreen interactions. Other researchers, not me here at Penn, but other folks around the world, are working on bare finger interactions with screens, and I think that's hopefully to come in the next several years.
With the idea that you could use your bare finger and you might feel something that would feel like a feather or corduroy?
Sure, that you could pet your cat on the picture or the phone, or you could feel different surfaces on the screen. But that's actually a pretty hard engineering challenge to make actuators in a transparent screen that can also sense. So good research out there.
But it seems like with touch, it's about vibration, right? That it's the vibration that creates the sensation of touch?
Your fingers can feel many things, both vibrations, like you're talking about, and pressures and temperatures. For a tool holding a stylus, a stick, and moving it across surfaces, the vibrations are actually, my lab figured out, that's where most of the information comes from. But when you do touch with your bare finger, we would love to be able to present different deformations across the surface of your finger, because there is a lot of useful information there as well.
But are we talking about just the aesthetics? I mean, living in a world of tech, I don't mean just like to minimize it, but the idea of what something feels like, looks like, design, touch, all that matters to human beings.
It does. So we've been talking with some folks at Adidas who design shoes and other sporting equipment. They are designers, would love to be able to feel different materials as they're crafting a new product, so we could add some efficiency to the design process. Or maybe we talked to some folks at Samsung as well on improving the interaction when you're writing on your tablet device. Wouldn't it feel nice if you could feel the paper, or when you switch to a different pen, feel as though it's now a ballpoint pen or an ink pen? There is some work on how haptics, the physical reactions to your motion interfaces like this, does actually make people more efficient. Mm-hmm. It's more natural. You don't have to visually wait for the confirmation, but it reacts more like the real physical world, so people can be speedier in, say, writing or make fewer errors.
Daniel, let me turn back to you, because I know you have done some work on self-driving cars.
Yes.
Little Ben being one of them.
Yes, exactly.
Who and what is Little Ben?
So this was a car that we basically took a Toyota Prius, and we added sensors to it so that it could make a three-dimensional map of its surroundings, and then the computers on board the car were then able to figure out in what situation where it should drive, how to react to changes in, say, intersections, and then be able to actually control the car so that it actually was able to drive on its own without a human driver.
And what we're hearing, I mean, this is a pretty quickly evolving technology. It seems that self-driving cars seem to be pretty much on the horizon.
Exactly. This is, you know, it's remarkable how fast this has gone from the research stage that we did at Penn and other institutions across the country to now where companies are very interested in actually deploying this. And hopefully in maybe 5-10 years, you will be able to buy a self-driving car.
Because it seems that cars tell you more and more about issues about safety. You can, you know, there are little cameras now. You can, you know, look out the back of your car. There are beeps that go off if you get too close to somebody. Is that all sort of part of the mechanics of a self-driving car?
Correct. A lot of the robotic technologies that were developed are actually finding them ways into these higher-end cars for crash avoidance systems, adaptive cruise control. These are all technologies that kind of came essentially from the robotics field and now found its way to help human drivers, but and taking some of the redundancy out of what humans have to do.
And can self-driving cars deal with human beings that are driving cars near them, talking on their cell phone, putting on their makeup, not paying attention to the road?
That's a big issue, is a distracted driving and how to deal with trying to anticipate what maybe stupid humans are going to do in certain situations. And that's really the challenge, is having the machines anticipate all those different scenarios.
Mm. I mean, are we even close to that?
It's a difficult problem. One of the problems with the way we think about building these systems is, as human designers, we try to anticipate all the different possible cases and scenarios that might occur. And that there's just so many different things. And so we would like to try to have the cars or the robots learn how to do this on their own, just like we teach our kids how to drive, right? To have the robots learn how to do this on their own.
You're chuckling, Catherine.
Oh, can you imagine, like, I'm going to teach my robot car to drive today. I'm going to demonstrate how to drive down the road, and then maybe it'll get smarter. But you don't have to teach each robot car on its own, right? Can't they all learn from each other?
They will learn from its own.
I was wondering about that.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you definitely, with robots and computers, you have a lot of the data, and, you know, you have lots of data, and you want to kind of be able to put that together so that they can learn from each other and from human examples as well.
Is it practice, practice, practice? Is that how robots learn?
Well, there's different ways of learning, but the more, I think, immediate application that I see is that these robots actually can be potentially much safer than human-driven cars. I mean, if you take, imagine you're following a car, and imagine you see the red light go off, and if you look at the amount of time it takes for you to react to that red light and slam on the brakes, the best of drivers probably take about 200 milliseconds to react. Well, robots can react instantaneously.
Wow.
And that doesn't take a lot of learning to do. I mean, robots are actually very good at that. I think anticipating people is actually quite hard. We have a hard time anticipating what someone else is going to do at a four-way stop sign. And that's what the little Ben was able to do. In fact, if you look at some of the videos, there's a really cool example of a four-way stop sign, a traffic jam at a four-way stop sign, where our car, Dan Lee's car, actually pulls out, and it's quite remarkable.
So this is, and I was saying to you, Daniel, before we going on the air, which was when I first heard about self-driving cars, I felt like, no, I don't want to do that. But it's beginning to make more and more sense, especially when you see how badly people are driving these days.
And, you know, drunk driving, you don't have that problem with robots. And elderly, to help the elderly, right? Once your grandparents cannot drive anymore, they lose their mobility. And that's a big problem around the world. Can we use technology to help these types of situations.
Let me just quickly reintroduce everybody. That's Daniel Lee. He joins us along with Catherine Kuchenbecker and Vijay Kumar, and we're getting an update on the very cool field of robotics and all the things that have been happening in the field of robotics. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. We've been talking about their individual projects that they're working on as well. I can see some overlap as well as they describe what they do. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Coaim. Vijay, I sort of threw that overlord question at you, but I think it's a serious one, that this idea that somehow robots are going to take all our jobs and essentially make humans either irrelevant or unemployed or all of that. But I just want to expand on your view of robots and the development of robotics.
I think as with any technology, robotics is going to have a disruptive influence on what we do and how we do it. And you can go back in history. You can look at typewriters, the weaving machines that replaced the hand looms. Historically, most of these inventions have led to more jobs being created. And if you look at the last 15 years, the same is true for robots. There was a recent study done in 2013 across all developing and developed countries, including the U.S., and even though unemployment has fallen in some countries, there's no correlation between the growth of robots and unemployment. In fact, there's only one country in which the number of robots have increased and the rate of unemployment has increased as well, and that's in Japan. And that, I suspect, has got to do with problems that are completely unrelated to technological issues. In fact, in the U.S., the number of robots has been increasing steadily over the last 15 years. And although recently we have experienced a drop in unemployment, it really has very little to do with robotics.
I was reading about the 3Ds, that robots are equipped to do things that we consider, I guess, dull, dirty, and dangerous. You're nodding your head, Daniel.
Yes, exactly. So if you think about, those are the first types of applications of these robots, is to take out the dull things, the dirty things, the dangerous things from our lives. So these are the types of tasks that humans would have a difficult time doing.
Whether going in, let's say, you know, going into a building that might be have fallen down because of an earthquake or something, and going inside and trying to see, are there people in there? Is it safe? Can we send other people in there?
Yeah, I think that really is, I hate to use the adjective killer, but that is the killer application for robotics. I mean, you imagine a situation with wildfires, for example, and we send some of our best and most courageous and smartest people in to fight wildfires, and it is really it's a profession fraught with all kinds of danger. And actually, robots can do this much more effectively. The other effect that robots can have on all of this is you can have a few trained personnel, but you can have lots and lots of robots helping these personnel. And so these robots can be force multipliers, if you will. And it's true for wildfires. It's true for reacting to, for example, nuclear accidents. You might have asked, in Fukushima, why didn't we have this fleet of robots to send in to go in and determine where the radiation leaks are, what the quality of the water is? And I think if Fukushima, and I hope this never happens, but if it were to happen 5 years from now, I think robots will be the first responders.
And haptics plays a role in this as well, Catherine?
It certainly does. In situations like Vijay was just describing, we bring in human operators to remotely control a robot. Right now, those interfaces require a lot of practice to get really good at. It's kind of some joysticks and buttons and a low-resolution video, and the operators get really good at it. But we're working on technologies to improve those interfaces, to make it easier for a person to pick up a new robot, drive it around, and then do much more dexterous things, cut the blue wire or the green wire, or do surgery. We work on surgical robotics also, where surgeons are using a robot to reach deep inside the human body through tiny incisions and make repairs and diagnoses there, where the human can't go so easily.
So a surgeon is there working with a robot, the robot going where that surgeon can't go?
Yeah, so the robot I'm talking about now is the Intuitive Da Vinci Surgical System. It's the only FDA-approved robot in the U.S. for minimally invasive robotic surgery. And so the whole idea is that instead of having to make large incisions to get a doctor's hands and eyes to see the structures that are diseased, you can make these tiny incisions and then have a robot with long, thin instruments and wrists, tiny wrists, mimic the movements of the surgeon just across the room. It's not usually done remotely, although it could be done, and to do operations. But these robots presently don't have any intelligence and also don't have any haptic touch sensing.
Yeah,
and so
yeah.
The surgeon, as they're doing these operations, can't feel what the robot's touching, similar to how an operator using, say, a bomb disposal robot or inspection robot can't really feel what it's touching. And so we've been working a lot on what signals can we measure on the robot and then present to the operator in real time to give them more information, mm-hmm. to let them make better decisions and deliver better treatment or accomplish the task more quickly.
Because I would assume surgeons do use touch. That's and your dad was a surgeon, right?
Yeah, my dad's a general surgeon in Los Angeles. And even the, yeah, all surgeons naturally use the sense of touch. They're palpating. They feel contacts through the instruments during open surgery. They rely hugely on it. You can't even turn off your sense of touch. You don't know how you would be extremely clumsy with no sense of touch. You definitely don't want a surgeon without a sense of touch, I tell you that. But that's exactly what patients are going into when they get surgery by a robot. The surgeon that has to have learned to compensate for a lack of sense of touch with their eyes, with what they see on the video. And people are very intelligent and they do this, but it's a tricky process. New surgeons, say a resident learning to do robotic surgery, has to figure out that mapping between what they see and what they would be feeling if they were holding the tools. And so my lab invented a new way to add touch feedback, and we've been studying it. We've actually shown that residents who train with this haptic touch feedback, they get better at surgery faster than residents who learn without it. And we've actually taken videos of patients undergoing surgery at Penn in the hospital of the University of Pennsylvania, and the residents who trained with touch feedback deliver better surgery than residents without.
Wow. Daniel, it looks like you want to add something.
Yeah, I think Catherine's work with robotic surgery is a great example of how robotics is used to enhance the capabilities of human surgeons and to allow them to do tasks that they might not be able to do, or to bring surgeries to places where there are no human surgeons there, but maybe through telemedicine could do this. So these are all examples of how robotics can be used to enhance kind of the quality of medicine as well as helping human surgeons.
We're not at the point where robots can think, though. Or are we? I mean, I'm looking at you, Daniel.
I would say we're still pretty far away from that, that having robots that can think and reason as well as even animals is still pretty far. They don't really have a good sense of what's happening in the world around them. They have to be kind of taught, you know, individual kinds of things, and they don't understand how to generalize to new situations as well as humans or animals do.
Because to me, thinking is about making associations, right? I mean, it's about many things, but one of them is making associations.
Or and also to think about how it relates to previous experience, and that's still pretty difficult for robots to handle.
You want to add to that, Vijay?
Well, in some ways, actually, robots are better than humans, right? So if I ask you to go into a building that you've never seen before, and I give you, let's say, 10 seconds, 10 minutes, maybe 10 hours, and then I ask you to come outside and describe to me what you've seen inside a building, a robot would be far, far better at doing that than you would be, because if I can equip it with sensors and I can train it to map buildings, which we already know how to do. So this is an example of very structured task that a robot could be programmed to do better than what humans can do. So there are many point solutions at which robots do exhibit artificial intelligence, or what people commonly associate with artificial intelligence. But as Dan said, if you scratch the surface a little deeper, you soon realize the limitations of what we're able to do currently with these kinds of machines.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. I do want to get some callers in as well. We are talking about robots, talking with Vijay Kumar, Catherine Kuchenbecker, and Daniel Lee. Calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email. Any questions or comments, radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can send us a tweet at Marty Moscow. Wayne, stay with us. We'll be right back.
Upland Country Day School, a pre-K to 9th grade independent school in Kennett Square, Pennsylvania, supports WHYY. Located on 23 acres and convenient to Westchester and Wilmington, Upland promotes high expectations within a program that balances challenging academics with athletics, the arts, and global citizenship. Small class sizes and dedicated teachers help their students reach their full potential. Upland now offers merit scholarships for grades 6 to 8. More at uplandcds.org.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Gabriel Sherman talks with us about Fox News CEO Roger Ailes, the subject of Sherman's new book, The Loudest Voice in the Room, how the brilliant, bombastic Roger Ailes built Fox News and divided a country. Join us. This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Somewhere along the line, the modesty, humility, hey, don't look at me filters get switched on.
Even when women themselves will say, absolutely no, I do not subscribe to this, this is ridiculous, it still feels uncomfortable.
A social scientist figures out a way to switch off what it is that keeps women from bragging as much as men. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with three leading roboticists from the University of Pennsylvania about some of their innovative and, I have to say, very cool research that they're doing. Daniel Lee heads up the GRASP Lab. Catherine Kuchenbecker specializes in the field of haptics, that's touch-related robotics. And Vijay Kumar designs autonomous flying robots. And let me get to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. Diane from Newtown joins our conversation. Diane, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm wondering if the researchers ever find that the research works sort of in reverse. I'm the mom of a one-year-old who's got some delays and he's trying to learn how to walk. And I'm just wondering if your work with robots ever, you ever find yourself finding things that sort of inform doctors in terms of how people adapt to walking or folks with mobility issues, some of the issues that they might be facing.
Well, that's interesting. Daniel, can I toss that first to you?
Sure. There's a close collaboration between kind of people at the medical school and our robotics lab in looking at how algorithms used for, say, walking is and how we use sensing to do that is how that influences animal behavior, human behavior in terms of learning how to walk. And there's a lot of interesting research in terms of what is important and what are the stages of development that need to be that need to be addressed so that we can get our robots to do the same things as humans do.
Anyone, do you want to add to that, Catherine?
Yeah, some of the technology we're working on in our lab, we also try to turn towards rehabilitation or physical therapy purposes as well. So I collaborate with folks at the Moss Rehab Research Institute here in Philadelphia to create technology for stroke patients to let them practice and do physical therapy. We actually use a Kinect video gaming sensor to see their motions of their arms and present almost like a gaming interaction on the screen. And then they also wear a wristband and an armband that can deliver different vibration sensations to help guide them, say, lift their arm higher or improve their range of motion. That's a second way. Right. Not only fundamental insights like Dan was talking about how the human body works, but also can we turn technology to help people who want to improve their capabilities get better or get back capability they used to have.
Vijay, you want to add anything to that?
I think there is a very close connection. However, our understanding of walking is quite limited. And our ability to get robots to walk like humans is also quite limited. And in fact, if your viewers are interested, there was a recently concluded robot challenge competition, and you can go to the website, therobotics challenge.org, to see what the state of the art really is. And there are all kinds of interesting approaches to it, but we have a long way to go before we're really able to walk the way even one-year-olds can walk.
Diane, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me see what Bob from Allentown has to say. And Bob, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for the fascinating research.
You're welcome.
My question is, since you folks dissect human behavior and human capabilities at their most elemental levels, when you go home at night, what's your takeaway about the grand design of humans that you guys work with every day? And is there a spiritual component when you go home and reflect on all this?
Bob, that's a great question. Vijay, I'm going to start with you.
I cannot comment on the spiritual connection, but certainly working in a field like this makes you marvel at what nature can do. not even going to humans, but just going to animals. If you look at the dexterity that monkeys, for example, have, robots are nowhere close to that. If you look at, I mentioned ants earlier, if you look at how they behave like, you know, as social animals and how they're able to collaborate, although their nervous system is so, so primitive, I mean, we don't know how to create robots that have those kinds of behaviors. So certainly there's a lot to think about and reflect on, but you also have to go back 50 years ago to see where we were, to see the enormous progress the field has really made.
Do you look at humans differently, Daniel, having worked in robotics, and just sort of marvel at our ability to navigate the world?
Definitely. I think it's incredible how exquisite humans and animals approach these problems in the real world, especially if you have kids. You see, your kids will easily put any of our robots to shame, and that's a general fact about animals and human behavior.
Can we think about evolution in robots?
That's a neat thing that I've been seeing more in the robotics community. Maybe when I started in robotics or even earlier, a robot would have just been programmed by a graduate student sitting there typing all day, programming it, and that graduate student's intelligence was going into the code to make the robot respond in a good way. And now we're trying to do more autonomous learning, so robots can learn on their own through their own behavior, from their own experiences, it's called developmental robots or machine learning, robotic learning. Dan is quite an expert at this, actually, to enable a robot to learn more like a kid, because it's not sustainable. We don't have enough graduate students or graduate student time to program every robot perfect if we want to create robots that can generalize their experiences.
Yeah, you want to add to that?
No, I think that's perfectly said. It's how can we have the robots learn and develop as if like kids do? And then it's really, you know, an interesting problem. And what can we learn about us doing this?
And the spiritual thing, I want to toss that to you, Catherine, just because you're working with, you know, a tactile sense. Is there a spiritual dimension to your work from your perspective? You don't have to label it.
I don't. Presently, I don't have any strong spiritual connections. I did recently speak with a graduate student who's doing religious studies, and he and I were talking about how haptic technology could be used to capture experiences and recreate them. But we don't have any. I'm not yet haven't yet explored that.
Okay,
too much.
Fair enough. Bob, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me see what Ralph from University City has to say. Ralph, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi there.
I'm absolutely loving. Okay, can you hear me?
Yes, indeed. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm absolutely loving this show.
Great.
I'm a full disclosure. I'm an old Grasp Lab groupie from back in the days when Dr. Bodonia was the dean and Dr. Baichi was running the Grasp Lab.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a question.
Sure.
Do you guys still have the Puma mechanical arm?
Yes.
This is a very inside conversation here, Ralph.
So
you said yes.
Yes,
Catherine.
Yes. A Puma is a robot that was used for manufacturing and assembly. When I started at Penn 7 years ago, we were looking through a storage room in the basement, and we found several Puma robot arms. And my husband, Jonathan Feeney, and I and some students got one of them running. And I actually have been using it in my graduate-level robotics class. We had the students do two projects, a Puma dancing project, where they had to choreograph a robot dance to 30 seconds of music.
Wow.
And then we did a light painting project where we put a colored LED in the end effector, the hand of the robot, and then those students had to program all the inverse kinematics of the robot arm to make it paint different designs in the air. And we do a long exposure photo, and you get these robot pieces of art that the students have created. So we are actively using a Puma still at Penn in the Grasp Lab.
Dan, did you know that there were groupies to the Grasp Lab?
Yes, and Ralph, you're definitely welcome to come back to see the Puma arms
We'd
as well as the
We'd love to
new
show
robots.
You around.
Go ahead, Vijay.
So, Ralph, one of the things that has changed is that these robots, if you had come back 25 years ago and looked at these robots in the lab, they would have been chained off, right? There was this robot zone that humans were not allowed to enter. Certainly, students were not allowed to enter unless you were one of those students that was working on the robot. I think things have changed now. I think robots are a lot safer, and they're now being designed for helping people, which means they have to be in the vicinity of people, and there has to be ways where humans and robots can collaborate, and that has changed significantly since the days you might have been at Penn.
Ralph, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's see what John from Reading has to say. John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi there.
So
I'm fascinated by the field, and I agree with all the potential positive capabilities, disaster assistance, et cetera. But what sort of worries me is the potential negative applications. So from what I've read, it's the stated purpose of U.S. intelligence agencies to have sort of micro-robots capable of entering, you know, businesses or homes for surveillance and that sort of thing. And I'm wondering, you know, in light of the NSA disclosures, if any of the guests have thoughts on that.
Sure, John, it's a good question. Vijay, that's in the ball's in your court, so to speak.
Are we on air? Are people hearing us?
Yes, they are. Yes, they are.
I think as citizens of the society, we have to be very vigilant about how technology is used. But that doesn't mean we stop investing in the technology. I mean, you can go back. I mean, my favorite example is really the work that Irene Curie and others did on artificial radioactivity, which led scientists, of course, to explore biologic phenomena and develop power sources, sustaining power sources. But, of course, it also led to the development of nuclear weapons. And I think robotics really has that kind of a disruptive potential to it. You know, one question is, you know, you can think about these small robots doing damage, but the question is, can they do benefit? And you really have to look at this cost benefit analysis, and you also have to have a society that's vigilant about how this technology is being used. So I think there's a technology side of things and a policy side of things, and these two things go hand in hand. And it's up to us to develop the right technology so that we can inform policymaking. And not let the policymaking get ahead of the technology or behind the technology.
We had a similar tweet from Tariq. New technologies can be hard for lawmakers to understand and to regulate. I think sort of underscoring what you're saying, which is when something is moving so fast, can our legal profession keep up with it?
Right, and you brought up the question of lawmakers. I think we cannot be proud of the number of technologists and engineers that are serving in Congress right now. But you know, it behooves us again to be more engaged as engineers, as technologists. I think more of us should spend time on the state Senate in Washington D.C. and really play an active role in this.
Well, we need more STEM, right? Teachers and people in the fields of science, technology, engineering, and math.
Yeah, I think it's definitely important for us to get to young students and to really show them what this technology is and how you learn about it. And Catherine definitely is one person who's really done a lot of outreach in that regard.
Yeah, the Grass Lab on a whole does a lot of outreach to the surrounding areas. We bring lots of kids in to see demos. And who doesn't love a robot?
I was just going to say, who doesn't love a robot?
We programmed the PR2 to give high fives and fist bumps. And we actually use the tactile sensors in the robot's hand to react and go to the next high five. And it also gives hugs. That's a great way to inspire kids to do their math homework and learn about physics, learn how to program.
Let me get, looks like Mike from Branchburg, New Jersey, to join our conversation. And Mike, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Oh, hi, thanks.
Hi there. Sure.
Yeah, this stuff is really exciting. And yesterday on the radio, there was a professor of drone journalism from, I think, Oklahoma. And he was talking about how, you know, as consumer drones become very affordable, you know, $400 or $500 for a drone, you know, how we'll have to figure out how to, you know, make laws and how we'll have to utilize this consumer drones. And I remember there was a drone manufacturer on the radio a few months ago on WNYC, and he was saying how one of his clients used his personal drone to hover over his kid's bus stop in the morning so that he could stay indoors and keep tabs on his child who was, you know, out at the street waiting for the bus. And I was wondering, you know, this stuff is so cool, and we'll all want to use it. And do we really think we want to go, you know, into a society where we sort of use these consumer devices, these consumer drones, to do things like, you know, watch our kids at the street so we don't have to go outside?
Well, Mike, I'm going to toss that question back to you, Vijay.
Well, I mean, I think you bring up a great question, and it's not unrelated to the discussion we had earlier. There's clearly potential for the technology, and the question is, how do you use it? I think there's one cross-section of the society who would basically say that as citizens in a free country, we should be able to explore potential uses of technology. I mean, gosh, we don't legislate firearms. How can we legislate tiny robots with cameras watching our kids, right? I mean, on the other hand, I do think we have to be responsible citizens. I think any time you have a 5-pound object flying in the sky that has a potential to just fall, come crashing down, you can do some serious damage. Mm-hmm. There's also this question of privacy. I think if you had a journalist taking pictures outside your house, you would scream at that journalist, and the journalist would know that he's not or she's not doing the right thing. But what about a journalist that is sort of snooping down from the sky? Who owns the airspace directly above your house? Well, if you say you own it, well, guess what? Today there are satellite pictures of your homes that are now available on Street View, for example. So I think there are these serious issues, and we really have to think about this interplay between technology, get the technology developers involved in policymaking, and the other way around. So what technology can be used to inform appropriate policymaking, and the other way around too, what policies should we formulate that can ensure that technology development happens? Mm.
We have just a minute or so before we have to say goodbye. And Daniel, I'm just curious about what are you working on right now?
As Vijay mentioned, we were involved with this DARPA Robotics Challenge, which was to make a search and rescue robot that could walk into an environment and you know, help rescue someone from rubble. And this is a very difficult problem, and we're still a long ways away from what human responders can do, but this is, I think, a great application of robotics.
How about for you, Catherine?
So many things. It's hard to even count. One thing we are hoping to do is to run a clinical trial of our touch feedback system for robotic surgery at the hospital, the University of Pennsylvania. We're in the planning stages of that. Really excited, because that would take a technology that began in my lab that we've patented all the way to the point where it could be helping doctors and patients in the hospital, and that would be really fulfilling. But we're working on other stuff I can't really tell you about also.
Stay tuned. How about for you, Vijay? I know you're working with the White House now, but...
Well, in my lab, besides working on aerial robots on search and rescue, we're also looking at applications in precision farming. We look at how to get robots to behave, to swarm, to perform tasks that individuals cannot perform. And we're also developing micro-robots that might be used for research in systems biology and for high-precision drug delivery.
Wow. Well, it's been a great pleasure to have all three of you with us in the studio on Radio Times today. And thank you for bringing two robots. Vijay Kumar, thank you very much.
Thank you for inviting me again, Marty.
You're welcome. And Daniel Lee, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Marty.
And Catherine Kuchenbaker, thank you for joining us as
thank
well.
You.
And we did put a video, actually, on our Facebook page of one of Vijay Kumar's robots, or actually a bunch of them, playing the theme song to James Bond. Check it out. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about our program. Send us an email. As I said, check us out on Facebook. You can tweet us as well and find out about satellite radio. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.